Hey, this is Cleveland Brown, and you're listening to the About Last Night podcast. I guess your TV must be broken. Ha ha, just kidding. Actually, I'm not kidding. You're bored.
Hey guys, Adam Ray for the About Last Night podcast. Happy Monday. It is ALN Classic Episode Week. Oh yeah, baby. We're taking a week off, and we're putting up a few episodes of Brad and I's favorites. Today is a guy you know from Bobby's World, from Gremlins, from Deal or No Deal, from America's Got Talent, from his stand-up comedy, from his personal appearances, from his being a comedy icon. Sat down with us for one of the funniest 90 minutes we've ever done. I'm talking about the great Howie Mandel. Holy shit. The stories in this episode will blow your mind if you haven't heard them. A lot of these old eps, you know, we always got new listeners. So, and it's tough with all the episodes to get through all of them. So we thought we'd post a few of our favorites and have you go back and re-enjoy or get reintroduced. Reintroduced? Jesus Christ. You know, sometimes when you're just like, talking is tough. So enjoy this episode and enjoy Thursday's episode too, which will be the great Jeff Garland. Tour dates. This weekend I'm in Austin, Texas at Cap City Comedy Club. Come out and see me, Austin, Cap City, Wednesday through Saturday, the 16th through the 19th of August. Tickets at adamraycomedy.com. This weekend, Brad Williams, Saturday, Sunday, Ontario Improv. And Friday. Brad will be there the 18th through the 20th. That's Friday through Sunday. Ontario Improv, Southern California. Go out and see your boy, Brad, the 18th through the 20th of August, Ontario, California. Tickets at bradwilliamscomedy.com. AboutLastNightPodcast.com for ALN merch and old episodes. We just got our mock-up of our new site, and that will be up very shortly, so stay tuned for that. And make sure you subscribe on iTunes for episodes. And rate and comment on the iTunes page. Helps us climb the charts. And email us at aboutlastnightpod@gmail.com. Your favorite moments, your highlights, where you get the show, why you got into it, what you love about it, and we'll read some of those on air, and you'll have a chance to win some merch. All right, now that we got the merch out of the way, the tour dates, you know the Twitter handles and Instagram shit, motherfucker, so sit back, relax, and enjoy an ALN classic episode with the hilarious Howie Mandel.
Well, the weekend's over, so it's time to chat about it. Got a midget and a Jew, so why don't you sit down and listen to a dope podcast. It's about last night.
How long have you had this spectacular warehouse here?
I've had this warehouse for about a year now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it's spectacular. It's a warehouse, but it's right in the heart of where it all happens.
Yeah, the porn valley, you mean?
I'm in the heart of the porn. You know, it's very funny because I was looking at a warehouse for years. We had offices on the lot at Universal,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to have my own.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to be renting offices at so I started looking. I thought the Valley, and I wanted to be in the Valley, and I thought I want to be close to film.
Mm-hmm.
So what film is done in the Valley?
Porn, right?
So when I was looking at warehouses, because I had a lot to do, a lot came with showers, a lot came with mattresses, a lot came with...
Oh, God, used,
you know,
or
but
new?
This was an actual warehouse. They were okay. Actually manufacturing. So I took this and kind of gutted it and built...
Now, I want to know, did you bring in the ping pong table, or are porn stars big pong players?
There was no porn in here, but the building next door is porn.
Yeah,
right.
You know, so...
I thought you were about to say it's haunted, but maybe it is haunted by porn.
Porn haunted. Has there been like a haunted porn?
No, but they're probably... Well,
there should be. Should there be like ghost hunters, but instead that they just go to like old porn sets and be like, if you can hear us, give us a sign, make some jism drop from the ceiling.
Ghost hunters. That's what be... I think it's haunted in there.
Yeah.
Let's go in. You know, that makes sense, because when there's a haunted house and then they get out, when you see those movies, I don't really like horror movies because it's bullshit. Like, if you were scared, why would you go back in?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But if you thought a vagina was haunted, everybody would go back in and then out and then in and then back in again.
It's the power
and
of that product.
I left my cat in there. Let me go back in. It's the power of pussy.
Yeah, I mean, that incredible. that would be something to where when your friend is bragging about how he's had like a Maxim model or something, you would kind of be able to look at it and be like, you ever have ghost pussy?
Oh my God!
Doesn't compare. Wow, doesn't compare.
But I just the only part of it, I don't mind the hauntings and the sounds coming out of there and the creaking and that. It's the cobwebs. Creaking. You don't want cobwebs in there.
You don't.
No.
You don't ever want cobwebs.
Not in there.
If you take anything away from this podcast and Howie Mandel, you don't want
something is tickling your face. I don't think that's. Whoa! Did you hear that? Let's go in deeper. Let's go in deeper.
See this is what I love about you, Howie, is you just kind of, and no matter what you're doing in your career, you've always been great at improv. You've always been able to just kind of go. And like,
I don't know that's improvisation. Is that considered improvisation?
Was that a bit?
Brad,
that was his Ghost Hunters bit.
Oh,
you haven't heard it yet?
The world famous Ghost Hunter bit.
Yeah, for years. I saw an old Carson clip where you were running it on the show.
Yeah. Ghost Hunter. But I'm getting a reading. You know what? That would be, I'm not a single guy, but I'm not married, but that would be, I would actually use that as a pickup line.
Sure.
They find that if you believe you could talk to women, and you tell the women that you believe, what is it called when you're possessed?
Yes. Yeah.
How does a spirit get into you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Through your vagina.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to attach a little meter to the end of my penis.
Yeah.
And it's not, we're not fucking.
No.
No. No.
Get that out of your head, Suzanne.
No. Yeah. I'm ghost hunting.
Ghost hunting.
What I'm
There's
doing
a difference
is
if
I
you would listen.
I just want to get a reading.
Yeah.
I just want to get a reading.
I'm going to put a crystal on the end
of
my
dick. Make sure that it's all clean in here.
Yeah.
And the whole family can move it.
This house is clear.
Yes. Because I once met the Amityville whore.
The Amityville whore. Not horror.
No, the Amityville whore.
Whore, yeah. Yes.
Because a family was once massacred in her vagina years ago, and then another family moves in.
Wait, and then the walls of the vagina just start talking like, yes. Get out. Like that.
Nice.
Come in.
Come again. Nice.
Wow.
So that's
nobody does that. Are there porn whores?
Porn.
There's got to be. Porn has parodied. I feel like most everything. Because then I've seen sketches where they are you know doing parodies of parodies.
Yeah.
I want to just say one thing because you are a master of voices. Now Brad just took a stab at a potential voice of the vagina in that scenario.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah, and as a guy who does voices on the reg, do you think that would be the go-to,
or do you have, if you were to do a voice of a vagina, would there be some other take?
We like to ask the hard-hitting questions on this podcast.
Yeah, that's good. Hello. Hello. Where did that come from? Hello. It's got to come from like inside the pants or beneath the dress.
Yeah, right.
Hello. It's got to be tight-lipped.
Yes.
Yeah,
well,
you can't enunciate. Hello.
Pun intended. Tight-lipped. Yes.
Hello. Hello.
It sounds like an older Skeeter.
Skeeter is a good name for that. Did you see her Skeeter?
What? See it?
Oh my God!
I lived in it.
You want her to have a Skeeter rather than an animal.
Muppet Babies is forever changed for me. I'm never gonna look at this. Oh God! I mean, that my childhood is just taking a dramatic turn for the worst.
Always entertaining.
How did the gig of Muppet Babies even come to be? Was that were you already well?
I had one voice. You know, I do different voices, but I got hired to do. I did the first. I did that voice, the Bobby voice.
Yeah,
you know, when I was a kid, I was choking on something. At a birthday party, and when your voice is have, you know, people say, "How do you do that?" And it's not like a falsetto where you try to talk high.
Right.
That's not what it is. But when my throat was half closed, so something was halfway down my throat, and don't try this at home. But I was choking on something.
Are we still talking about porn?
We can. I'll segue into porn.
Jesus, Brad. Okay. We're trying to transition.
Sorry. You know when you take a balloon and you blow up a balloon and then you stretch the nipple?
Here yes. We go. Yes.
You stretch the nipple of the balloon and it squeezes out at a high note.
Yeah. Right.
I was trying to get air out. I had something halfway down my throat and I'm going, help me. Help me. I can't. Oh my
That's
God.
That's the voice that was coming out.
That was the voice. And people are laughing and I'm dying. And then luckily got dislodged and I live. But I thought to myself, this was an amazing, besides a near-death experience.
Sure.
I had an audience. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to replicate.
How old were you at that age?
Probably 11 or 12.
So wow. That was maybe your first recognition of like, oh, like you
no,
getting.
Nobody really enjoyed me, but they were looking and fascinated by the voice. I mean, I was just at the birthday party gotcha. Because it was a cousin.
Right. Death you and, know? Death and
but
funny
then
sounds.
I learned to make that voice. I trained the muscles in my throat to tighten my throat, and I can squeeze the air through. I can do that voice when I have no voice, when laryngitis, because it's only air.
Right.
I'm doing it with air.
Oh, shit.
You know, I'm just pushing air through. Like the top of a balloon when you stretch a balloon.
Yeah.
You know, so, and then I would go to school, and in the back of the class, I could go, help me. And people would laugh. The teacher would catch me and go, Howie, if you have something funny to say, tell the whole class. I talked about that in my act.
Yeah.
But anyway, I started doing that voice. And when I came out here and did comedy, in stand-up comedy, I was doing that on stage, the voice, as a, you know, a baby talking filthy.
Right. Because you didn't have, like, you didn't have the idea of Bobby's World in your head like that or
no it was in my knee. No, I didn't have any. I was just going to do stand up. My whole career is an accident, you know. I got dared to get up on stage to do stand up because in the mid 70s, you know, these comedy clubs were coming up. I'm from Toronto, Canada, and the comedy club came up there. And
was it Yuck Yucks back then? Or
it was Yuck, and it still is.
Yeah. All right.
Yes, it still is Yuck Yucks. So I went to, in the mid-70s when disco was all the rage. I was not into disco. I'm not a clubber. I don't go dancing. I don't like dancing. I don't play poker. I don't do sports.
Right.
Really boring. I'm a post country.
And,
we went because I hadn't been to a live stand-up comedy show.
Yeah.
You know, I'd seen in Toronto Second City, which was sketches, but I had not seen live stand-up beyond The Tonight Show. So I went, and it was fascinating to see somebody live, you know, riffing and telling jokes and saying things that seemed in the 70s, you know, pushing the envelope like I had never seen beyond the, you know, the language and what they were talking about. It was hysterical. It was electric. It was alive. And then at the end of the show, the host got up and said, you know, Monday nights are amateur nights. And the people at the table that I said, you should go on. I went, oh, okay. So I showed up on that Monday.
It's important to have those friends, by the way, to give you that little extra boost, right?
It could have been the end of it, you know, of the friendship, because it could have went, because I didn't really plan on what I was going to do and what was going to happen.
You didn't have notes or anything like that, or did you have any sort of idea?
I never did homework in school, and there was no reason. I don't have a GED. So I went, okay, I'll show up, because they said I'm funny.
Right.
And so I went up, and that was the beginning of my career. I mean, it was just the first time I heard a laugh was, you know, like a warm blanket. You know? I went, this is it. This is.
Right.
Yeah. Holy shit.
Yeah, it's incredible.
This is it. And still not an inkling of this could be a career.
Right.
So I would show up 3-4 times a week, and they were giving me spots, and I could do this voice. And, you know, I would talk as in this baby voice, Bobby, but I would talk. Filthy,
right.
Talk about filthy things.
So
and the
funny.
Juxtaposition of, you know,
yeah,
you know, the filthiness in this voice.
By the way, I feel like having that voice is 90 some percent of it, because it's like
it
insert filthy thing because the voice is so spot on and believable as like what kind of thing. So would you have the baby
I mean, I'm laughing.
I mean,
yeah, and there's not even a joke there.
Yeah.
It's just to have this voice.
It's so innocent.
Dracula. You know, so I used to get laughs, really easy laughs. But anyway, I forget what the question was, but I'm going to continue to answer.
The voice of Bobby. So you're doing it on stage.
No, it was the voice of Skeeter.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I started doing stand-up. When I came out here on vacation to Los Angeles on vacation, I went to the Comedy Store to see the mecca of comedy.
Because this is what year then?
78, 77, 78.
So who's going up at that point?
Yeah, who's their guys?
The MC is David Letterman.
Holy shit.
So pretty much nobody's.
Nobody.
Yeah, just know, hacks.
And, Brad, we're trying to get Dave on the podcast.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah. So David Letterman, Billy Crystal, who was doing soap at the time, Robin Williams. I'd see Rodney Dangerfield working out his Tonight Show sets in the other room. It was like really the Mecca. Johnny Carson would stop in to work out his sets for the...
Just like played, the Tonight Show monologues?
Vegas. No, Vegas. He was doing Vegas. I watched. I'm going to jump ahead when I made it out here, not to live. I hadn't made it. Mm-hmm. I would go every night. I watched Richard Pryor go on every night and work out his set for Live on the Sunset Strip.
Oh my god!
Which kind of was
that set
the most moving, career changing time in my career because I saw what. It was like to
saw the best.
I did see the best, and he is certainly the best, and he is my inspiration. But the bravery in being able to get up on stage and work it out,
yeah,
right.
You know,
and you
and
see
learn
the process,
and listen, and watch the process, and yeah. you know, it was
because just, up until that point, you were maybe not as fearless. Do you is safe to say? Or,
I didn't understand.
Yeah.
You know, everything was happenstance. It was by accident. You know, I went up and I acted goofy. You know, if people remember me from the 70s and the early 80s, the truth is, I got up on stage the first time unprepared. Mm-hmm. You know, and what I learned from that, and then I got really nervous because they went, ladies and gentlemen, Howie Mandel, there was a light in my face and all right. these people, strangers are looking at me. And I went, oh my God. Oh, okay. 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 And I started doing okay. And they started laughing at okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And then I went, what? What are you laughing at? Yeah. And my act was really.
You would kind of smack yourself in the head.
Nervous.
Yeah.
Neurotic
crazy
Jew.
Energy, asking them what they were and just and making weird noises and laughing. And it was just fear. It was a. Total fear. But what I right. learned was the honesty of, you know, letting something die, if it does die, talking about the fact, you know, if people see you struggling, even if you're struggling and you admit you're struggling, there's a relatability.
They're on your side.
That
kind of
worked. But anyway, so I started doing these voices on stage and I was doing them at the Tonight Show and I went in and auditioned for Muppet Babies.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the one voice I was doing. So I did Skeeter.
Yeah.
Did you audition for Jim Henson?
I did see Jim Henson.
I mean,
I
man,
for Jim Henson.
A hero of mine.
A hero of mine.
Oh, my God. What was that?
It's amazing if you go do, if you go in New York to.
The Creature Shop or what?
If you go to do Fallon.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Down the hall from Fallon, and it's been down the hall from, you know, when Letterman was there was I first saw it. The very first Tonight Show was in that stage, you know, that I think that's where Steve Allen did his show.
Yeah.
And Jim Henson, who was just a puppeteer, and it was way before the Muppets became what they became, was a guest on the Tonight Show. And in his dressing room, which they have since opened up on that floor, in his dressing room, they ripped off the wall and Jim Henson, out of the pipes and the plumbing, he made Muppets. He drew what later became like Beaker and Kermit, and he drew all those there. And he's got it all. It's all Jim Henson's art. He goes, you know, he was waiting 2 hours or 3 hours to get on the show from the time he went in and rehearsed.
Yeah,
couldn't shut that creativity off
on the pipes. And now they have that wall open. If you walk down the hall, they will show you. There's a plaque on it. I think it's part of the tour where you can see Jim Henson waiting, creating all that art.
That's unreal.
Just scribbling in his downtime.
Yes.
And
it's brilliant.
Yeah, he was a genius.
He was a genius. So I went and did that. And then...
how did you... You read for him and did he give you direction or did he... You just kind of did the voice and he was like, that's great or...
Yeah, and that was it. I got that. I don't remember that being such a long process, but he just thought that would be cool for Skeeter. And we had a read-through. I actually auditioned for somebody else, but then I met him at the first read-through of the Muppet Babies.
And do they give you the... Because I read for a lot of animation now, and that's like a dream of mine. You know, now that I have nieces and stuff, all I want to do is be a voice of a cartoon.
Right.
And you know, a lot of times you get the, you know, picture or a description of the character. Is that how it was? Or sometimes they
they gave me a picture of the character. But Skeeter was already... This is Muppet Babies.
Yeah,
so Skeeter
was
already a character that... existed,
right?
But
so now you
Scooter's
just have to,
sister, yeah, that's right.
Yes, Scooter's sister.
So now you just have to do the kid version
of that. And I did
that,
and I did Animal because I had heard Animal. So mm-hmm. and I did Beaker, you know,
which is the really too? High.
No, if you don't listen to me, I'll make your sister disappear.
He was a scientist. The assistant.
That's right. Scientist with a riff.
Oh my God. Scientist with a lisp.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Beaker had like a buddy that
Bunsen
was.
Bunsen Honeydew.
And he was the high pitched one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
He was the me. Like yes. That one, right? Okay.
Oh, no. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
All right. Sorry. I'm trying to get all my ducks in a row here.
Those are ducks. Those Muppets.
True.
So anyway, I did that show. And my friends who were Second City, Jim Stahl and Jim Fisher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jim Stahl is on Mork and Mindy. He played Mindy's brother.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think he was even the mayor on Mork and Mindy. He was a good friend of mine, and I knew him from the Comedy Store. And Fox was going to start their network. They started their network with Joan Rivers doing her late night show.
Right.
And they wanted to start a Saturday morning Fox Children's Network.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a development deal because they're great writers. They wrote a bunch of movies. And if I had Google in front of me, I would figure out which movies they wrote. But they're
Air
really
Bud
good writers.
7?
Sure. Classics.
Talking about classics. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they had a development deal, and they had a development deal for Saturday morning for cartoons.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they came to me and said, we should do Bobby as a cartoon. And I went, how the fuck are you going to do this
foul
mouthed little? They said, well, no, we use that voice, but
right.
What if we, and we just sat down and we said, well, they said, there's got to be a million funny stories. And then we thought Bobby Generic, which is just generic. Why don't we do this generic 4-year-old
mm-hmm.
who's, you know, I had babies at the time. We were all kids for a few years earlier in our life. And
hope so.
Said, let's tell our real stories, and we can do it through our imagination, and like what we will become the, you know, it would be our fantasies. And
yeah.
So we pitched it, and they said okay. And then you know, I would sit there and talk like this, and this is Bobby, and I'd sit there with an artist who would drew. He goes, you think you look like this? And I go, no, I don't look like that. I got black hair. And then they would do that, and he would draw. He
That's
drew
amazing.
It right.
What a fun process.
A real fun process. And who would think that it would run for 9 years. It would Jeez. Be a precursor to like Rugrats.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, you set the table. You were like the New Kids on the Block
Steven
of children's cartoons.
His right. TV Guide said it was his favorite Saturday morning cartoon. It ran for 9 seasons in 60 countries. And
well, because like every children's show is always adults talking at the kids and kind of like, hey, we're going to do some fun stuff today. We're going to go over like
right.
it's talking at the kids. Bobby's world was, no, this is the kid's perspective.
Yeah.
This is,
or just a real perspective.
Yeah.
I think they understand. You don't have to talk down to kids. Kids
right.
would like to think up to us.
Sure.
So we did what we thought was funny. We did our takes on pop culture. In fact, I'd love to relaunch it one day, and there's talk of that now.
Ooh.
And then my friend who I worked with on Bobby's World, and I had worked on another show called Laugh Tracks, which was a sketch comedy show with mm-hmm. A bunch of people who went on to become pretty famous, but Frank Welker was on it. And Frank Welker is the Mel Blanc of our time. Frank Welker
oh, wow.
is, if you look, he's every character, every cartoon character.
Just every voice. Yeah.
He has every voice in every movie. They were doing Gremlins.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought me in to just meet because they needed a million voices.
Sure.
And they showed me a picture of Gizmo.
Yeah.
And again, I just did the Skeeter voice. I did the Bobby voice because.
So yeah, I was gonna say like how many you weren't were you at this level where you were in like the world of working voice people because of the success of Bobby's World? Is that
did at that Bobby's World? I was never in the world of successful voice. I've never been hired for anything beyond. You know, I did Muppet Babies. Mm. And Dave Coulier ended up taking my place. I kind of backed up because I was doing a lot of stand-up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had a series, and I started doing movies. So I backed out of the last – I think he did the last 2 seasons.
Right.
And he
– Solid
he,
replacement.
He mimicked my voices.
Yeah.
And then I did Bobby's World, which is just me, you know,
right.
doing Bobby and myself. And then I did Gremlins. I'm Gizmo from Gremlins,
yeah.
which is the same. But I didn't – I've never done anything
And that
else.
Job came because you knew Frank? Is that
– Frank Welker.
Yeah.
Yeah, who got me into that and
Shit.
Introduced me to Joe
That
Dante.
Stuff really plays a factor in all this, yeah? Like just having any sort of relationship.
Yeah. It's funny because there's no better power in this business and nepotism, and you don't have to be related, but
no.
if you know somebody,
yeah.
it's just, you know, it's like it is like our gang, you know, all our friends get together and let's put on a show.
Yeah.
And I love that camaraderie.
Right. And people want to work with fun people that they're used to working with. So if you show up on set one day and you're a great person to work with and you're easy to work with, then they're going to want to hire you for the next thing, or when they're going to think of you when Frank goes to Gremlins and says, "Oh, we need more voices."
Well, he got me the audition.
Yeah.
And the audition was in Burbank. I'll never forget, in a building, you know, that's where they were doing casting, not a show business building. In fact, on the floor where they were auditioning for the Gremlins voiceover talent, it was the same floor as a gynecologist's office. And there were sounds. I don't know which
that's
one
the office we're
going
to use when we cast Ghost Country, by the way. Is the guy, yeah, it's the gyno office.
See? And ladies and gentlemen, this is the circle of life. We go from cartoons to cunt. I think we're going through
from cartoons to cunt.
That'd be your
we're
next
still
book.
In the seat. Yeah. Can we move in? We're going to talk about D's. We'll talk about D's.
Let's go down the alphabet, man.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
All right. So then, same thing with Gizmo. Where you get to kind of talk out maybe how you see, or do they give you a
no?
The
that
puppet?
Was that movie was done and completed.
Gotcha.
I watched the movie, and we had to, for lack of a better term, lip sync.
Yeah.
To what was going on, and so we would sit in a sound stage and watch the movie from a booth and with a microphone and what do you think he's saying here? I mean, they knew what he was saying, but how do you think that would sound?
Right.
You know?
Did you ever feel like fucking with the voice and maybe not doing a sound, but maybe doing like a, hey, it's me, Gizmo, a.k.a. Tony Danza, or doing like a, and just putting some actual character to it?
There is like
some real dialogue.
I'm sure there's tapes.
We added things because in the big crowd scenes, I did Gizmo. And what was funny about Gizmo is it wasn't really, you know, besides saying things like, light bright, which was, take off on light bright.
Yep.
When it played, it became a huge international success and all over the world. They
incredible.
Wanted people to be able to relate to it. So they would bring me back in, you know, a month later because we're doing it for Germany. And you know those
Gizmo in German,
right? So or Japanese.
Yeah.
So he had to sound like we would redo the movie, like my part in the movie, so that he would sound like some little German. You know, like something sounds
angry
like,
Gizmo.
If you could only see how his face as he's doing German Gizmo
or Japanese. You know, you had to make him a little.
What about Jewish Gizmo?
I love that when you were doing German Gizmo, Adam as a Jew still got a little fearful.
I'm sweating a
just
little.
This like a it's cute and it's cuddly, but it's still that it's still that dialect.
I had a Gizmo doll. That's how you know how. I mean,
did you have a Gizmo or a Furby?
Ooh,
see,
I'm.
Do you know what Furby is?
Yeah. I'm positive it was Gizmo.
Yeah.
Furby. I think there was a big lawsuit. They asked me to do the voice of Furby.
Really?
They didn't.
Well, because it's the same.
It's the same thing.
Yeah, it's the same thing. They watched that and they said, oh, instead of brown and white, let's make them purple and have the eyes roll in the back of the head, and then we're good.
And then we're good.
Was there ever a time after doing all these, like doing Gizmo and then Bobby? I mean, it wasn't. They wouldn't like at the end of the show put your face up at the end. So like, were you kind of? But I mean, you were out there with your stand up, obviously, right? So like,
my career has been so fractured in the sense that. When I first started, one of the first things that got me national recognition was Make Me Laugh. That's where I, that's the first TV I got. And then I got known as a stand-up comic, and I became an opening act for like Diana Ross and Earth, Wind & Fire and
Holy
Jose
shit.
Feliciano.
Yeah.
And
Billy Ocean ever?
That's kind of later. That's way later. I didn't ever open for Billy Ocean,
not with that attitude.
And then I got a Young Comedian special.
Yes,
on
and
HBO.
That,
kinda, yeah.
that was a game changer. And on my Young Comedian special, it was me, Jerry Seinfeld, Richard Lewis, Harry Anderson.
Oh my God!
And Maureen Murphy. That was my Young Comedian special.
What Mary fuck lineup. Kill, huh? that's a great lineup.
Yeah,
yeah.
And that kind of so then people knew me as the insane manic comic. And then, you know, and I was touring and I was doing theaters. And then when I got Saint Elsewhere.
Right, which is a drama.
Which is a drama.
Yeah.
You know.
Medical drama.
Yes. Regardless, it's still a drama.
Right.
Medical, cop, whatever. I played Fiscus on Saint Elsewhere for 6 years. That audience was a very, you know, the people that would watch Saint Elsewhere, they would stay up at 10 o'clock on a weeknight to watch a very serious, well-constructed, fabulously scripted drama with Denzel Washington and Norman Lloyd and great classic actors and me we're not the people that were watching young comedian specials and goofiness. So I would get letters. That's when before email. I would get letters saying, "I have a bet with my husband that that Fiscus is not the same guy that puts the rubber glove on his head."
And you're depending like, on sorry.
If they would split the money with me, I would say whatever they wanted me to say. So I did that. And then when I started Bobby's World, you know, young moms and dads who are watching cartoons with their kids. You know, I was in the live action opening and closings of it.
Yeah,
but those weren't the people that were watching dramas at night. They weren't the people that were watching stand-up comedy. So when I would do a stand-up comedy show, I'd get a bunch of moms sitting there with like three-year-olds. Because they said Howie Mandel. And they knew Howie Mandel.
Yeah.
So my audience was really fractured. So there's people who are Bobby's World fans. There's people who were saying Elsewhere fans and movie fans. I did a couple of movies in the early 80s. And then there were people who were stand-up fans.
Yeah.
And they were very separate. And it took years and years and years. Not until I did Deal or No Deal.
Mm-hmm.
That was the biggest widest swath of like everybody who
kind of brings everyone together.
That brought everybody together where I had one fan base where they go, "Oh, you know, you're Howie Mandel. I know."
Right. And so now you think when people come to see your shows, they know what they're coming to see. They're not coming
absolutely
to see.
Absolutely not.
Really?
Because still, as somebody who is probably more widely known, you know, you hit more of an audience with AGT as a judge, and they remember Deal or No Deal, they think of me as this kind of clean-cut host.
Right.
And but as a stand-up comic, and that's something that I'll never stop doing, it's very improvisational. It's very in the moment. Mm-hmm. It's not family-friendly. I love stand-up and will never give up stand-up because that is my one primal scream. Everything else I do, you know, there is a mark to hit, a line to recite, a commercial to throw to, a
producer
sponsor,
in your ear.
A producer telling you what to do, and there are sponsors who don't want you to cross the line. And I feel like in stand-up comedy, it's about crossing the line.
Yeah,
it's about being free. It's about being... So, you know, if you think... And not that I'm going to offend anybody, not that I set out to personally, but I just want... I love this free kind of spirit.
You want the freedom where you're not going to be in your head when you're telling a joke thinking, "Ooh, that would be really funny, but then that sponsor might pull out of..."
Though, you know, and I say that to you now. The truth is, I think our climate is changing, and it's really depressing the world of stand-up comedy now because
of the social media.
Social media.
The quick response for people to...
Quick response. And
the amount of uninformed blogs or sites that are not credited, we're in an age too where people don't fact check. So if it's posted on Facebook and a link that says like this comedian did this, people will immediately just go, "Well, it was posted on Facebook, so he must be a piece of shit."
The term social media bothers me because the media used to be something that you had reverence for. Media, at least for us who go into media is television, television reporting.
Yeah.
It is journalism, which is newspapers and that. But now social media, what is social media? It's some guy in his underpants in his room writing what he thought he saw.
Right.
And that little tinder can, no pun intended with the Tinder, that starts a fire. And we have no, and I hearken back to what we talked about earlier. You know, I watched Richard Pryor try anything and everything to get that right. And the art of comedy is the art of free speech and poking fun. And if you can't poke fun, if you can't throw a miscolor on your canvas and go, no, I got to tone this back a little bit. Oh, I got to curb that. If you can't do that without somebody recording you and then taking what you say out of context and judging you and the possibility of you losing sponsorships and jobs and whatever.
Yeah,
it's a scarier place.
It's this thing where now, I mean, I saw a great interview with the late, great Patrice O'Neill, and he said comedy is about having the freedom to fail.
Right.
We have to be able to go up and talk about topics that are not traditionally funny, the darkest things ever. But we can kind of make that funny, but we need to be able to fail and a few times to finally get it right. Now you're up on stage and you look out and you see people who are smiling, but also their phones are up and you're like, "Great. I can't."
And then they'll show that little video to somebody and they'll critique it based on like what was happening. A, off of that small little video, and then B, you know, they won't give it a their full attention. That's my problem with it too. And it's also like the people that'll sit back and judge are people that would never, they don't even give any sort of validity to the idea that somebody is got to a point in their life and career where they will be so fearless as to try to bomb, you know, or to say something. It's like they're
but
not even taking.
I don't think most people have a sense of humor. You know, I did a book, no, but they don't. I don't think that is a sense. It's like, do most people have fashion sense? Do most people right. have, you know, or do they have a good sense of, you know, the word sense is mm-hmm. what is key here. And for to be a comedian. To have a sense of humor isn't about, you know, telling a joke. The reason that I can tell you that most people don't have a sense of humor is the reason for the laugh track. You know, that is the industry's way of telling the audience that that was a joke, laugh here.
Laugh here, yeah.
Yes. So the point is, and if you hear the rhythm of a joke, we mm-hmm. kind of know the rhythm, so we know to laugh at that. But the people that construct jokes and have a sense of humor, mm-hmm. you and you, mm-hmm. That always comes out of darkness. It's always got to come out of something that's not funny. And I've said this a million times. You know, comedy is not really, it doesn't come from anything fun. I mean, even if you take a little kid to the circus and you see the clown fall down,
right.
you're laughing at somebody else's misfortune.
Sure.
They have found a way to make, and when two guys walk into a bar, something shitty has to happen to somebody.
Yeah.
For you to laugh.
Yeah.
Comedy can't be, hey, me and Adam went out to a bar, we had two drinks, we had a great conversation, and then we got home safely.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just home in Seattle with my 2 6-year-old twin nieces and my 2-year-old nephew, and I will do a lot of puppet stuff with them because they're still at the age where they right. are all about it. And there's this chicken puppet that I have, and I was playing with my nephew and talking to him, and then with a crayon, he proceeded to beat the chicken mercilessly, and my nieces started laughing, and he started laughing. And right. I'm like, yeah, this is funny to you guys, but it's also animal cruelty. It's also fucking, you're beating him with a crayon, which is a new way to, you know, you're taking this, you know, artistic tool and turning it into a weapon. But it's like that was, they don't, they see
there was
as,
a victim there.
Yeah. But the truth of the matter is, that is funny.
Mm-hmm.
And why is it funny? Because it's taboo.
Well, because the voice I was doing of the chicken was spot on. It's also, it's also the trailer voice for Ghost Hunters. Okay. So, yeah.
But yeah.
But the point is that that's funny.
Yes.
But you cannot have cruelty to animals. You know, people are so sensitive on TV, or if you mm-hmm. say you did, it's a joke. We're not killing a chicken. That's
right.
not a real chicken.
Yeah.
That's not a crap. But that wouldn't fly with sponsors and everything. Kids with a pure sense of humor know that it's funny. Why is it funny? Why are they? Because you're not supposed to do it. Taboo, mean, hurtful, awkward.
That's a great point.
Embarrassing.
They know that you're not supposed to do it.
All the elements that makes great comedy. And even if you look at old-time comedy, seltzer bottle in the face.
Yeah.
Pie to the face.
Pie in the
yeah.
face. You're ruining somebody's clothes. You're ruining their time. You're ruining mm-hmm. their party. If you take away all the
Three
humor,
Stooges.
Three Stooges.
Dude, blowing up the glove
other,
on your face.
Yeah.
Right. But they're hitting each other. They're
yeah.
hurting each other. That is comedy.
Yeah.
Now, the idea that a large group doesn't find it funny. You know, I've talked about this too. When you go to amateur night
mm-hmm.
and you watch somebody bomb horribly, and you go, "Oh my God, why is that?" You know, who told him
right.
that he could get on the stage? The truth is, somebody did tell him.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. somebody laughed, and I think that the people like you and me and all of us were really lucky that our sensibility—and that's all it is—that our sensibility is shared by more than just Uncle Morty.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
our friend.
Yeah.
yeah.
The fact that you're not doing anything on stage that you don't think is funny and you haven't found funny. But there are people that won't find it funny. You know,
absolutely.
I'm always cognizant of the fact. I remember one of the greatest days of my, and this is how I think, one of the greatest days of my career was I sold out 2 shows at Radio City Music Hall.
Holy
good Lord.
One night.
Yeah.
You know, and it's probably 7,000
yeah.
Seats.
At least.
So it was 14,000 people in New York City. And I remember looking out the window in the corner of 6th Avenue, and 14,000 people were there, you know, 6,000 coming out, 7,000 coming in.
That's an epic venue. I just saw Chappelle there last year, and it seems like the best for stand-up.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It mm-hmm. was amazing. And my wife was, I was with my wife, and my wife was saying, isn't this amazing? And my mind went to this, but this kind of speaks to it. 14,000 people bought tickets to see me
right.
in a city of 10 million. 9,985,000 right. people decided there's something better to do than to see how it
Jesus
ended
Christ,
and
man.
And that kind of speaks to the fact that, you know, the guy who gets on stage on Amateur Night and says all this crap
right.
that nobody's laughing at in the silence, he has an audience of one. The fact that
right.
I got up there and my nervous energy and I blew a glove up on my head, and
mm-hmm.
which many people would argue is not funny and is not even comedy, is nothing, was shared by enough of a mass that I could pay my rent. So we're just really lucky that some people share the same sensibility. It's
yeah.
like, how many people like a song? How mm-hmm. many people like a painting? How many people like you putting these words in that order?
Just like any form of art. There's it's fascinating to me that if you go to Rotten Tomatoes and you go to the movie Goodfellas, which I think is one of the greatest movies
one
of all
of
time,
my favorite.
Is there's it has a score of 99%, and you look and there's one critic that just says, nah, this is horrible. Fucking Goodfellas. The
right.
One of the most perfect movies of all time. Someone is able to look at the same piece of art
right.
and just say, nah. And as a comic, you're right. That's going to happen where you're trying to just appeal to have people find it funny as many as you can. But there's
relatability. You
yeah.
know, we're all human. And we all suffer from the exact same, you know, maybe for different reasons, anxieties and
mm-hmm.
pressures and things like that. And if we could just tickle that, just poke that,
sure.
and that's what we look for, just relatability. And the way to find that is within yourself. You know, if you are true to yourself comedically, you know, like what makes you laugh, what you found really awkward, hopefully there's somebody else out there, another human being that mm-hmm. kind of relates, and that makes you laugh.
When you,
the humor yep. comes from the darkest place. How many
yeah.
times have you laughed at a funeral?
Or, yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Because you're just, and it's almost like the mind is craving it in that moment. And one of my favorite things to do on stage is to make it very tense in the room, because then the release is so much bigger. When you have a moment where you stop talking for a second and then you listen, and the entire comedy club, or in your case, theater, is silent, you're like, ooh, I've got them.
And they're listening, yeah.
Yeah.
They are.
Like,
well, silence is golden. It really is. No, but it is.
It is.
I love it.
Did it take you a while to get to a point? I'm curious, too, like, at what point did Howie Mandel hone in on your sensibility and become aware that, oh, wow, there is, like, a mass of people that are have similar sensibilities as me?
I'm still coming to grips with
yeah.
that. You know, the truth is that you're always trying to...
Because you say, like, on these shows, like Deal or No Deal, or even AGT, like, that, you know, you're not maybe as free as you would be on stand-up, that's safe to say. But you're still, I still feel like I'm still seeing, and even talking to you now, I still feel like that's, you are who you are on TV. Like, I don't
you
think
are,
you're...
But, you know, what I found is to not get so inside it,
yeah.
even in comedy, mm-hmm. and just do it, and then hope, you know, it's beyond you. And I'll give you the example of Deal or No Deal. When Deal or No Deal was offered to me, I said no fucking way. I got a call and they said that we want you to do a game show. And
yeah.
I said no. And you got to put this in perspective. In 2005, you know, as a stand-up comic, the irony of being a, you know, that's a kind of a punchline
yeah,
to
right.
be a game show host.
It's almost like kind of like being a cruise ship comic where it's like, oh, you're a comic, but you do cruises, then you must not be doing well. Or like,
right.
so you're a comic and do a game show?
I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
They said, well, just can we, and they phoned me back and they said, can we pitch you the idea? NBC is going to give this a push like they've never given. Nobody has given 5 nights of primetime television
right.
on a network to this. This is the biggest format in the world. You know, America was like the last one on board. This was all over
yeah.
Europe.
Oh, really? It was a
huge hit.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
All over the world.
So that made you listen a little bit?
A little bit. And I said, no, I just don't want to do a game show
yeah.
because I want to be mm-hmm. a comic. I don't want to be this punchline. I want to be, you know, I'll act.
Yeah.
I wasn't really acting at the time. And they said, will you just listen to the pitch?
Yeah.
And I said, okay, I'll hear the pitch. And then saw it, I was at Jerry's in the Valley.
Nice.
I don't leave the Valley. That's why you guys
are. You love it out here. You know, I love it.
I'm a Valley.
Hey, man, any place that has pictures of you and Oprah, I will stay as long as you let us.
There's a lot of pictures.
Yeah.
People
a lot. Yeah. It's incredible.
This is I got a warehouse of.
It's a great shot. There's Bobby dolls. There's I mean it's pretty.
Look
amazing.
At that. Yeah. I want to show you. I'm pointing out things on a podcast.
The Howie Mandel show.
Don't take these cards.
Yeah.
So when I first got my talk show. Uh-huh. There was a pile of cards. I asked to do my talk show on the set in NBC where Johnny Carson did his show.
No mm-hmm. shit.
Which is became Access Hollywood. So yeah. I was on. Yeah. I put my desk where Johnny Carson put it, and underneath the bleachers, which are still there, were these cards. And that is from his last. That's Johnny Carson's last show. That was the last.
Because it says Robin Williams, Bette Midler.
Yeah, and do not take these cards. And Bob was his cue card guy. That's the last cue card from.
Oh, the Tonight Show.
Holy crap. Because Bette Midler sang one for my baby, one for my baby, one for the road.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
That's an incredible.
And that picture beside it that you see the Howie Mandel show, that's that set.
That's amazing.
And right next to it, you have a pre poster for Ghost Hunters. This is maybe. Wow.
I'm always.
Always looking
always
ahead.
Working, always looking ahead.
Howie, that could legitimately be in like some sort of like Smithsonian. Yeah. That's an incredible piece of Hollywood history.
You know, and that was my first show on the set, and they weren't big then. And if you look, Jennifer Aniston was my first guest on that show, and she was dating Brad Pitt, and they told me I can't mention Brad Pitt. That was the first show.
First rule of knowing who Brad Pitt is don't say his name.
Right.
We can't even say it three times on this podcast.
What did you think of The River Runs Through It? Did you see that? They got really mad at me. And that's Usher, who was not a big star then.
No.
This kid is going to be great, I think.
Right.
See, I knew it.
And then there's Arsenio.
Jay Leno was across the hall, mm-hmm. and he came to wish me luck on my first show. So that's this thematic.
Yeah. Amazing.
Did you love, we'll get back to the Deal or No Deal story, but real quick, did you love doing the talk show?
I love doing it. Yeah. I did. Mm-hmm. You know what? It turned out not to be a great experience. I'll tell you why. Because they asked me to do a talk show. I was filling in for Regis at the time, and they asked me to do a daytime talk show. And then in daytime, I was so excited to do it, and I wanted to fuck around and be... Again, this goes back to being yourself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they made me dress in suits. They made me... I don't wear earrings now, but I was wearing earrings. But it's indicative of, them shaping you, and it's always about this business. It's always you're perfect. Now you're not gonna do this.
Right.
You can't say this. You know, we're gonna give you Jennifer Aniston, but can't ask the question that
about
you're even
Brad Pitt.
That anybody or yourself is interested.
But
be you.
Be the Howie that we love. But don't say Brad Pitt ever. And don't
right. So yeah. In that
and
way,
this.
It was not. Mm-hmm. Not fun, because I felt that's why I still love doing stand-up, because there isn't a...
You're not answering to anybody.
I'm not answering to anybody. And
talk about Brad Pitt as much as you want.
That's why I wanted to get off of Universal lot and buy a shitty warehouse in the Valley where I could just come and do whatever it is that I
do. No one's checking up on you.
Nobody. And if I have an idea...
There's no studio tour going by.
Yeah.
We have our own equipment. We shoot things. I have edit bays.
No one's saying, hey, Dr. Oz needs this space.
No.
Like you're
so
fine.
I can do whatever I want.
I love
this
that.
Is where so Deal or No Deal. Yeah. This is what I learned. So
you go to the pitch. They go, hey, at least come right.
I'll show you that here too. The guy shows up at Jerry's. He says it's the biggest thing in the world. I'll show you that on the wall. He brings. It looks like a special needs kid did an art project. Like this is supposed to be the biggest format in the world. I'll show you it. It's here. It's on the wall in the other room.
Okay.
He made an art card that he thought was. That looked like suitcases, and he showed me the show.
Yeah.
After showing me the show, this is pre me seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing. You're right. That's not it. There's no talent. There's no skill. There's no nothing.
It's luck.
An hour.
It's averages.
Open the case. Just that's my line. Open the case.
Yeah.
What number do you want? Oh, 7. All right. Open number 7. Now, okay. What number do you want now? 4. Okay, open number 4. And an hour of that.
Yeah.
An hour of that.
You're like, right. How am I supposed to make that
entertaining? Yeah.
So anyway, I go home and I tell my wife. She goes, listen, why don't you want to do it? I said, it'll ruin my career. She goes, you were at Jerry's and now you're home. That is your career. Take the fucking deal. So I go,
God bless your wife.
Yeah, she's the smartest one in our family. So I took the show. And I tell you, I wanted to quit. You know, I went there. Oh, and I said, this is another thing. This is so show business. So I said to the guy, because the guy's telling me, you know, the reason we called you three times, we can't do the show without you. You are so perfect. You're the one for the show.
Yeah.
We won't do the show if you don't do the show. It's amazing. We got to have you do the show. This is on a Friday. So when I call him, I said, well, do it. I go, when do you need me? He goes, well, we're shooting Monday. I go, you're shooting Monday? Well, don't you have to build a set? Don't you have to build a set? He goes, well, I have a set. We have the set built. Okay. I said, well, don't you need models? Oh, they're already hired.
You're like, but Monday's Rosh Hashanah. Yeah.
No, but the point is, how far down the list as my fucking name, if this thing's built and waiting?
Right.
Obviously, just, like, eight other people have quit.
Yeah. So that starts to seep into your brain?
A little bit. So then I say to myself, I call my comic friends, and I say to myself, this is how I'm going to handle it. The only reference I have to great comics that have done games in the close... what's his name? Groucho Marx.
Yeah.
Did the word, name that? Remember he did?
Password?
No. Groucho Marx did a show where the chicken came down.
I know what you're talking about. I don't know.
I've just seen tape of it. I never seen it. It's before my time. But Groucho Marx was a guy. He was like a movie star. He was a comic, and he had done a game. And I know that Johnny Carson had done it. This is like two generations prior to me.
Sure.
So I'm going to hire a comic to write with me, and I'm going to sit, and they said I can have a comic. So I had a comic who sat down with me, and we were writing, because I said, how am I going to fill the fucking hour about opening cases? And
right.
Was it a buddy of yours who was like, just knew your voice, or somebody who maybe had written for shows?
You know, and we're going to do this show, and anyway, Monday comes, and that's another picture. All these pictures are not just, it's not narcissism. They're reasons, but I'll show you after. But
also, you got to have stuff like this up to, A, for podcasts, but B,
for podcasts, there's no
well, to reference
on camera,
but also like how would I mean? I feel like having this, the career you've had and the body of work, and the as you said, even at the beginning of this podcast, where you said it was like an accident to see all this stuff and see the different,
like the different
worlds
states,
that you've gotten to work
your career.
Why would you not want to be reminded of that?
So, here's the thing. So I get to the set. I have this whole thing planned. And then we open the show. Like, the first show, I'm going to shoot six, all right? So, we open
in
the show.
In one day?
We're shooting one in the first day.
Yeah.
But I walk out, and they go, you know, and there's this big dramatic opening where I start in the vault, and I walk out, and then they go, and they only have to answer that one question, deal or no deal? And I say that, and the audience roars, and, you know, because they were told to. And then I bring up the first contestant, and I'll never forget, I could tell you right, Karen Van was the very first contestant, and I'm standing there, and this woman, beautiful young lady, is standing there in front of me, and you know, I've said, and you have to also realize, besides Who Wants to Be a Millionaire at that time, there's no other shows for a million dollar prize. Somehow today doesn't seem like a lot on TV because there's a lot of them.
Yeah, but then it was big.
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge. I think $1 million is still huge in people's minds, but a $1 million game show is something that we see a lot of.
Yeah.
But we didn't then. And I said to her, you have a chance to win $1 million. And I'm standing 5 feet from this person, and I realize, oh my God, this is a real person. And I interview her for a minute, and she introduces me to her three kids.
Right.
And her husband. And she's never owned a home. They're paying rent. They have no health insurance.
Shit gets real very quick.
That's exactly right. Shit gets real. And I figure, you know what? It doesn't matter. It's not about me being funny now. Yeah, I can get the best joke in the world, and I can get the biggest laugh in the world, but this is a real person, and with three
she's not going to find it funny, and
so
if she doesn't...
So my whole cadence changed. I said, I'm not going to... I just got, and I realized that when you watch people who don't know, people who aren't in television or in show business... There is something that happens to people when they, regular people, when they're on a set, there's 20 cameras, there's 500 people, you could see a glaze go over her eyes, like, oh my God, I'm in another fucker. You know, she wasn't from Hollywood.
You can forget to breathe.
Right. And people will tell you that when they're on the stage. I'm sure if you go to a concert and your biggest crush pulls you up on stage, you're going, oh, how?
That's why people faint. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I could see that there was a glaze in her eye just about being there and being given this opportunity. So my whole cadence changed. And it was about, you know, I would say, like, there's an offer would come in, and I would be really close to her and go, Karen, the offer is 200 $1,000. SNL started making fun of me and my cadence and how I...
which is awesome.
Yeah. Which was great.
Yeah.
But the reason, I'm telling you, the reason was I could see she wasn't... And I wanted you to hear. And really what I was saying is take the fucking money. You know, and they
would ever try to... Would the producers in your ear maybe like, hey, Howie, don't...
That, stop. Because I would say things like the... You can now take $200,000 or you can still take a chance at $1 million.
Yeah, and you say that quick and throw it away. Yeah.
Or go for a guaranteed
change your life.
Right.
Get a house
down payment.
$200,000 mean to you. Stop. You've never had that.
Yeah. Right.
Or you can take a chance at $1 million.
A shot.
A chance.
Not guaranteed. Yeah. Chance. No.
Guaranteed.
Chance.
Yeah. You would be really mad at me for doing that. But what happened is, and I dropped up by the wayside all my ideas for witticisms and being funny and making it about Howie Mandel.
Well, because you started caring about these people.
But what happened was, like comedy,
my empathy
kind of, that I think part of the, you know, the relatability of that show was you played along, you were screaming at the TV.
Yes.
And I had more fame and more, I mean, people were offering me stand-up gigs and everything that I was doing, a lot more than, there's somebody, you hear that noise?
Yes. So, yes. Someone's making coffee.
No, don't apologize.
It's okay.
Somebody
start over.
With
Jesus.
A Keurig machine making cappuccino. What are you making, Mike? Just a comment. Nice. The sound you hear in the background is Mike Marks. He runs our very astute executive producer.
Wonderful.
He's making coffee. That sound is not him peeing in the corner.
That's what it sounds like. I just wanted to. But anyway, what I was saying was the empathy that I ended up the It's okay. We'll wait till he's finished. We'll wait till he's finished. You think it's done?
These mics are good. I don't think they'll pick it up.
Oh, you don't think they'll pick it up?
No. Yeah.
There's a lot of noise behind me.
I asked the guy when I buy these mics at Guitar Center, I go, will we hear coffee made at Howie Mandel's porn studio? And he goes, Howie does porn?
Yeah, Ghost Hunter. Yeah.
Softball lob.
Okay. If really? He just takes it. Hold on. I also have to tune my tambourine. One second. I have to do that.
A whole quartet comes in.
Yeah.
Can my a cappella group warm up here?
The four tunesmen?
I know there's going to be like a crushing splash and bang in a second. What?
I have a. And if you spill, don't worry. I'm going to bring in the wet dry vac. It's going to make no noise whatsoever. You're fine.
Call somebody else to help you. You need help? Yeah. Timmy! Timmy! He's having trouble with the coffee. This guy behind us is trying to be so quiet.
Yeah.
I've never heard more noises come out of this. No.
See you, Mike.
Bye.
Parties at Don Francisco's house were less noise.
But what I was saying was the I didn't know that, so I did the show.
The amount of empathy you were saying,
I
too.
I threw out all my jokes because it's so important that this human, this real human being,
sure.
better her life,
right.
have an opportunity. My fear became that if I do a joke and I get a big laugh and at the, you know, she may focus on the laugh and not really focus on
the fact that she get about to get $200,000.
I don't want anybody, God forbid, the worst thing that could happen to me is somebody saying, the joke, I didn't even think I had four more cases to open. Oh. You were doing so fine. And that killed me that I could even
did
to
that
this
happen
day,
once and that's what?
No,
okay.
But to this day, you know, the NBC, who I love and has supported me, has asked me to do that. What's that show they do with all the games? Celebrity Game Night.
Hollywood Game Night. Hollywood Game Night.
And I won't do it. And they go, why won't you do it? And I said, because to go on television, I want to entertain. And because you have a real person there that's on the team with the celebrities, if I did something and distracted, and even if they made $50 less,
right.
I would cry. Because it would be for me. I don't want to be. I'll go out and entertain somebody, and I'll act like a goofball, and I'll do anything you want. But I don't want to be responsible for somebody else.
Nothing at risk.
What?
Yeah, you want to put.
That's,
yeah,
because so you're a great dude.
So what happened on Deal or No Deal is we did the show. It was about to air. And I, my wife, I said, we got to leave the country. I went to South America when it was going to air.
Oh, shit.
I didn't want to be any place. I said, it's terrible. Mm-hmm. They go, why? Because I was so excited. I said, I don't think it's... I spent the whole time making sure people won money. I didn't do any jokes. Mm-hmm. I was not... I didn't do anything.
You're known for comedy. Now you're not going to be... Is that what you're thinking?
No, but I didn't know that it was... I didn't trust the format in itself. And most...
Trust your instincts that you...
Well, I just did what Howie Mandel would do, mm-hmm. but not what a comedian would do, not what an actor would do.
And that was a new thing for you to...
Well, I just bared my soul. Yeah, that was just me. Yeah. But I was relating. You know, so I start getting tweets. I start getting emails. And the first night it aired, they go, "This, we just broke a record at NBC. The next night it aired, Tuesday, we broke another record from the night before. The next night, and every, it went up. Yeah. And I flew back. I landed in Miami. I'll never forget it. I walk off the plane within, you can count to 10. Somebody goes, "Hey, deal or no deal?" And from that day forward, my life, in
that's
this business
fucking,
has changed. It caught on, but it was something that in the moment I was so serious and so worried that somebody, you know, would be not offended, but be distracted. And it was just about making sure they won money. I didn't want to be a game show host.
Right.
I didn't, but it taught me a lesson, you know, just to be real. Mm-hmm. And just to be, you know, do what you do, and you can't control how other people respond. And in the same way in comedy, you can't control. Be real. Do what you think is the funniest fucking thing in the world. What is making you laugh?
Right.
If you're going into the toilet, tell them you're in the toilet. Just do that. You can't control the rest of the world. And what I learned from Deal or No Deal is from that time on, I've been so free just to be myself. It was such an eye-opening experience. You know, and those experiences are mirrored in other things. You know, when I did Howard Stern once and accidentally admitted that I had mental health issues.
Yeah, with your OCD. OCD, yeah.
With my OCD.
That was an accident that you talked
about? Oh, yeah. He was fucking with me. He wanted me to open the door when somebody was in there playing with their cock and they had touched the door, and he knew mm-hmm. that I didn't want to touch germs. And finally, I got an anxiety attack, and I said, "Listen, this is real." And that was years and years ago, before people were very open about mental health issues.
Sure.
And I said, "I'm fucked up. I go to a psychiatrist. You got to open the door. I'm having a panic attack. I'm going to have a heart attack." And I thought, I was devastated. I thought, you know, my career is over.
Right. You're like,
my
great. This is the thing.
But it kind of opened up to, you know, I've told that story before, but I walked out in the street. I was going to run into traffic, and somebody walked up to me and said, "I just heard you on Stern." And I went, "Holy fuck, that's it. This is the beginning of the end." And, mm-hmm. and they went, "Me too." And I thought, oh my God, I'm not alone. And,
yeah.
But all this speaks to comedy, and it speaks to whatever we do. We're all humans.
Mm-hmm.
We all have a cross to bear. And if you just are true to yourself, if you think it's funny, and even if it's tasteless, if you think it's, you know, if you want to go on stage,
you got to try, right?
Yeah, you got to try. But back to how this started,
mm-hmm.
our society as is not allowing us. And it's a shame, because, you know, young people are out there fighting a war for freedom and democracy. And our biggest freedom is freedom of speech. And when we have to be concerned about what we're saying or poking a chicken with a crayon, then that's not really freedom.
No, it's not. And
shit.
Do you
how often do you your son does a vlog, right?
Yeah.
Is it, share these sentiments with him as he's, you know.
Well, my biggest fear, and I do, you know, I want him to be free. I want him to be artistic. I think everybody's creative. I think everybody's an artist. I think it doesn't matter. You don't have to be a comedian. You don't have to have a podcast.
Yeah.
You don't have to have a vlog. Mm-hmm. You're an artist in what you do. You know, you got to find a new way, maybe find a way that feels better for you, like it's never been done before.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I we all, our world lives in fear of what other people will think. So this is a dichotomy, because I want you to be fearless, you know, and I tell my kids to be fearless, go for it, do it.
Mm-hmm.
Just find something you're really passionate about, you know, and I don't care if that's a fucking waiter. You know,
yeah.
Just do it and be the best fucking waiter you can be and look forward to get up in the morning and just go and do it. But by the same token, this is a very scary world, in the sense that you are an open book to everybody, whether you're vlogging or not. You know, you walk into a urinal, the next guy next to you has got an iPhone. So you're not, he could capture whatever he wants to capture.
Sure.
There's no private time anymore. And how is that information processed? So I want to warn them or educate them, but not scare them. But I want him to.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. You say you don't even have to be a comedian. I mean, there's that story of a businesswoman who is flying to Africa. She's not a comedian. She's not an actress. She's not in public eye. She goes on her Twitter and she goes, "Hey, flying to Africa. Hope I don't get AIDS, but I'm not because I'm white." Send. By the time she lands in Africa, this has been retweeted.
Somebody comes up to her and goes, "Deal or no deal?"
But this has been retweeted hundreds of thousands of times.
Yeah.
There's a hashtag like "When Andrea lands."
Holy shit!
Like, and when she lands to find out that she's fired, that her fiance has left her, and just like all this because she hit send. And she's not an entertainer. It just caught on and was like, how insensitive that this person has said this thing. So to elaborate on your point, it is scary. And not just for people that put themselves out there every day, but then for people that don't. Like, you, anything that you do now could be completely blown out of proportion.
Why? Right. I'm curious.
Everybody is so that everybody becomes part of the media.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm curious too, like, just how cautious now with the success, you know, Deal No Deal, and then now AGT, which I don't know if you can even compare the two as far as what they've done, show wise and for your career. But I'm assuming, I mean, it seems like it's just as powerful and popular.
It is. What's amazing to me, and nobody's more thankful, blessed, and surprised than I am, that, you know, today I can walk outside and somebody knows my name or has seen something I do. Because, you know, when I came in this business in the mid-70s, or I got to do the Johnny Carson show, my life changed the next day. But there was three networks. And if you did TV, we knew everybody on TV. You know, mm-hmm. You knew. Do you know who Donnie Most is?
Yeah.
Okay. So my point is, that's a third-tiered actor on a sitcom. That's a third tiered. It's not the star of the sitcom. It's right. A guy on a sitcom. I will ask you now, who named three actors on CSI, which is a number one sitcom? Can you?
Ted Danson? Is he still on there?
So but you don't know him from the
Chris
stars.
O'Donnell? Oh.
Okay, here's the point. The point is, you got to go okay?
Right.
Yeah.
That's a number one show, and people don't know.
Ask me the cast of Designing Women. I'll give you the whole cast from top to bottom.
So the point is that right now, the average home has 600 stations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They have internet. They have live streaming. They have gaming that they can do. They can play games on it. So just the fact that somebody knows you, that wants to show up, that sees you, and is phenomenal to me. So the fact that I'm on a TV show now that,
yeah.
You know, 10, 12 million people tune
per
into.
Episode, yeah.
Nobody's luckier than I am. The fact that I'm my age and still, you know, a lot of the comics that I started out with, you know, I could give those that you probably know because you guys are in comedy, but those are names of people that were great that people don't even know. People
right.
Like Tim Thomerson. Do you know who he is?
No.
You don't know?
Can't say that I do, no.
Oh, well, he, one of the best improvisational comics there ever was. You know Jeff Altman?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, same at the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
But I'm saying he was great.
Right.
He
and you see guys like that and you're like, why aren't they more?
But they were on The Tonight Show.
Right.
People knew their name and they were given shows and, you know, and then, the, you know, you have your time.
Some people, it happens and some people just, right? I mean,
but it happens and goes away.
Yeah.
You know, careers mm-hmm. are in ebbs
back.
And flows.
Yeah.
And here I am sitting here after all these years. And at this particular moment, I'm on something that people know. And any time I'm on something that people know and I can have a good time, I wouldn't have even dreamed that that was a job, what I'm doing now on AGT.
Right.
You know, you could be on a talent show, but just to sit there, I always want people to laugh and smile.
Yeah.
And now I'm sitting there watching a show that I'd be watching alone at home in my underpants anyway. now I'm there.
Commenting the way you would comment.
That was good. That was good. That doesn't seem like a job.
Yeah.
Do you think it is the two moments I'm curious too big? You'd say just to be lucky to have that job, but like also to be like when you Drew Lynch, who's a comedian, and that whole moment. I mean, that seemed like it was pretty
awesome. You know, to be witness to, just as good as I think it is to watch on TV, but even to be there live,
it's way better when you're in the room for any of this.
My
yeah.
God, to be there when somebody's dreams are unfolding in front of you. Mm-hmm. You know what this means to somebody.
A similar right. energy to Deal or No Deal when you're with them and the money's at stake, right? You're seeing these people on stage.
Well,
with
and the money. You know, you open up the four times in 5 years and 500 episodes that I opened up that case that they had, that they remained with,
and there was $1 million.
It happened four times?
Four times in 500 shows. And when I opened up that case and that person is standing there, their life was never going to be the... I had such a small part. I mean, that was luck, right?
Yeah.
Such a small... But just to be there and witness in the room, that energy, that electricity. I mean, if you're sitting in a room by yourself doing work at a desk and somebody's in the doorway watching you, a family member, you know, you get a sense that somebody's watching you or somebody's in the room. I think humanity gives off an... you know, kind of
some
electricity.
Some sort of energy that
there
you
is
kind of,
energy.
Yeah.
So our energy in life changes, goes ups and, up and down. You, and this sounds much more spiritual than I even mean it to be. But when you're in the room and up close to somebody whose life is changing, exploding, every dream is coming true. When you're in a room with somebody like Drew Lynch, and for those that didn't watch the show, he was a guy who got into an accident and he
softball hit him in the throat. Yeah,
and now he stutters. So being able to express himself is harder, and he's chosen the path of stand-up comedy, which is all about communication.
Right,
and he killed it. He crushed it. That audience was standing. That audience was screaming. The tears were rolling out of his eyes, and I got to press the golden buzzer to send them all the way to the Radio City Music Hall. Just to be a small witness to it was enough. Than to be, I would have been happy to be in the audience.
Sure.
And people told me, you know, I could see on social network what it was like to watch it. It is amazing, and it feels like a privilege.
Well, and whether you go to Deal or No Deal or America's Got Talent, you've got to witness, like you say, how many times can you, in someone's life, can a moment happen, and you go, okay, my life was one way until this moment, and then from here on out, it's going to be a completely different thing. Maybe, you know, when your kids are born.
Yes.
When you get when you get a crazy new promotion or a new job or or in your case, when you give someone a suitcase full of money, a contract to appear, a development deal, they win a competition, you're there for that moment where nothing is ever going to be the same again.
Usually those kind of life-changing moments, as you just pointed out, are usually private. And then, you know, my most life-changing moments, my two most life-changing moments, positive and negative, were the birth of my children and the loss of my father.
Yeah.
You know, both of those weren't, you know, for public consumption. So the fact that I'm part of something that is, I believe, equally as life-changing for these people, at least in the context of what they're doing and in their lives, to be there is amazing.
Yeah.
And that's why it makes for good television, and that's why they broadcast it.
Yeah. And do you have some sort of special soft spot for the comics that come on?
Yeah. You know, it's not even a special soft spot. It's a knowledge. Mm-hmm. And the knowledge is this, and you both know this as comedians. You know, we are given the short end of the stick.
Sure.
We really are. Yeah. Because people do not understand. They just think, you're funny guys, you know?
Yeah.
There you are, and you're just going up and talking. And it's, you know, Jerry Seinfeld, he once, I saw him win an award, and he said it best. He really did. He did this whole dissertation on, and I'm not going to do this justice, but I'll tell you, it's Jerry. They give him an award for comedy achievement.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, it's funny, because as a comic, we don't really get accolades and awards. You know,
no.
Even Johnny Carson, who supposedly celebrated comedy, you had to be waved over to come sit down. But Most would come out and sit down and talk about how he got into character. Or a singer would come out and sing a song that they didn't write,
right.
That they're just singing, and then they'd sit down on the couch. But a comic, you know, and even the clowns in the circus are coming at the end, and they clean up, and they're used as filler in between the
You have to be waved over.
But he said, it's very funny, in our business, you know, the people that get awards, and the most important night of show business is the Academy Awards, which gives awards to people who act. And think about the actor.
Mm-hmm.
So an actor will get up, and he'll usually be, he or she will be driven to wherever they have to go.
Mm-hmm.
And where they have to go, somebody will dress them. They'll help them get dressed. They'll comb their hair. They'll put makeup on them. And then they'll be sent into a room. And in that room, they'll put a piece of tape on the floor. And they say, what I need you to do is, when I tell you to go, I need you to walk in and stop at that piece of tape.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and when you get to that piece of tape, then they give them a script, and they go, "I need you to say
the ghost is inside that vagina."
Yeah, right. No, but I need you to say these words.
Yes.
Right.
So they walk in, and they stop at the tape and they say these words, and the director goes, cut, no, try it again, that wasn't good, you know, and then they do it again, and then they do it again, and then they do it again, and they do it again, so that the director can get like a really good angle, and then they go take that into an edit bay, and they cut it, and they put music under it, and you watch the guy go to the tape, not say any word he was going to say, and they go, fucking brilliant, that guy's brilliant. A comedian. Mm-hmm. A comedian writes his own material, creates his own character, does his own performances with nobody. He's self-directed.
Decides the order in which he wants to deliver it.
Yep. And has to elicit from a group of strangers a response every 30 seconds. Not an easy response. Not just a pattern.
On the first take.
Yes.
You can't be like, you know what?
That's it. I
didn't say that joke right. Let me try that again.
They go, that was funny.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is, you know, it's very funny because even when the comedians are hosting all these award shows, they go, he didn't do such a good job.
Yeah.
You see so-and-so's dress. Yeah.
You know, oh, my God. You're right.
And
fuck
ultimately,
that.
Right. Ultimately, you know, I remember one.
Seth MacFarlane. Carlin wasn't funny, but Gwyneth. Did you see Gwyneth?
But we say they're brilliant. And in the Academy Awards, people get up, and if they're going to make a political statement, they go, that is so – you don't do that at that night. This is a very pious night. This room is filled with people who pretend for a living.
And they're brave. Oh, the bravery, Howie.
And brilliant.
They're so brave.
And we'll take political direction from these people who pretend.
Yeah. Right.
But comics are nothing. And so my empathy is I understand what goes into it.
Yeah.
I'm not making more of myself, but it's just – harder to do to elicit laughter and to maintain a career in comedy than it is. You got to be lucky as an actor to get the part, and I'm not taking away from, there is a talent in pretending, but there's also a lot of help that a comic doesn't have.
Yeah.
And maybe somebody will take this statement out of context.
Howie says, F you, Gwyneth.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what he says.
Is that why you still do? Because Richard was telling us you have about 100 dates still a year.
I'll never stop doing that. No matter what I do, at least 100 tour dates a year.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I'm going to be on television, if I'm going to make television, I produce, I write, I perform.
You did our buddy Theo's show, Deal With It, which is so good.
Thank
Theo
you.
Theo's on,
But I think for me to have the sensibility, even as a comedian or somebody who does television, I think you lose it living here in L.A. and New York and just being behind the scenes of... This is not the real world.
No.
So
right.
To stand in front of an audience in Iowa, in Oklahoma, in Illinois, in where the world is real, and even through their sensibility of their sense of humor, you kind of get a sense of what people are responding to.
1,000%.
And you look at a lot of TV that's on now, the reason the networks are going into the toilet is I don't think they're speaking to the average people, the people that we have to speak to as comics who get on a stage in front of those people.
Somebody told me that Adam Sandler, somebody asked him, like, why do you make movies like Grown Ups and all this? He's like, I make movies for middle America because that's who goes to see them.
He's absolutely right. That's why he's successful, and that's why he deserves to be successful.
Yeah. Right. I did want to touch. Yeah, I did want to touch very briefly on your book because we both read it, and my dad has OCD.
Right.
And so we've talked to Mark Summers on this podcast, and we talked to him about the OCD, and to me, it's. The most fascinating part about meeting with someone with that condition is that they all know it's crazy, but they can't help it. Like they can't.
That's why it's debilitating.
Right.
If you didn't know it and it was just the way you acted, and if it the fact that it seems like you're out of control, you're controlling, you're obsessing, and you compulsively have to do things, and whether it's rituals or thoughts or my cleanliness or whatever it is, the fact that intellectually you know that this is not right, that it really doesn't matter, is what kills you and creates anxiety, And I just wish, it's something that I continually struggle with. As I talk to you, I'm medicated and I seek a lot of help for it. And it's hard, but everybody's got a hard time, and it's just about coping skills, But there's been so many times when I've been caught in the wheel of hell of trying to get out of some sort of skipping record.
Well, and my biggest question to you then is, how does someone with OCD and ADHD sit down to write a book? Because that seems like something that
that was one of the hardest things I had done.
Yeah.
It took over a year, and I had an editor and a co-author with me.
Mm-hmm.
What was his name, Rich? Who was traveling with me? His name's on the book. Anyway, we'll get, get his name. Is it here, the book? No. That's what I... All right. So anyway, he traveled with me, and like you're doing right now, we sat down and talked, and he always recorded.
Okay.
So he just kind of, you know, it is my voice, it is my words, but I had somebody curating and putting it in.
That seems like the way to do it.
Yeah.
Especially for a comic. Down. Yeah, because we talk.
He was on the road with me.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So off the, you know, in the hotels or at lunch, it took a year of just recording everything I said and then just transcribing that.
How many times would you go through and maybe just read the whole thing and be like, oh yeah, this is, I think you transcribed this.
Well, he
accurately.
Would transcribe, you know, like what we talked about last night.
Yeah.
And I'd go, you know what, that shouldn't be, what's his name? Josh Young.
There we go.
Yeah, it's so Don't Touch Me. You can get it, I guess, and I mean, the audiobook is what I listen to, which was
The audiobook's
fantastic.
On iTunes, the book's on Amazon. You can go to aboutlastnightpodcast.com, click on the Amazon banner, and then order Howie's book.
There it is.
And then go see him when he
HowieMandel.com, is that where all your dates are?
I came up with that, yes.
Well, I mean, Howie, just having this conversation with you has been so great because... you're an immensely talented guy, funny guy who I saw do stand-up a few weeks ago, and I had never seen you actually do stand-up before.
Right.
And that was so great to see you, and because I know you from Bobby's World. I know you from America's Got Talent. I know you from the game show. Even though I know you're a comic, I don't know you. I've never seen your comedy. So to see you be funny and still just... kill that audience. You had a great set that night.
I don't remember how the set went. I know that when I saw you, we were at the Laugh Factory. I was writing. We were going to I was going to be hosting one of the galas at Just for Laughs for the CW. I think that's going to air. And so I had to find material. So I went from club to club to club doing that, and that's where we met.
It's great that you still, Rich was even saying when you guys were up in somewhere in Canada where you would be having coffee and then you would pop in at
a club.
A
comedy
club,
that's where I write.
Yeah,
you know, that's how I write.
Because you're doing big theaters and stuff when you're touring, yeah.
Right, but writing, I really don't know. You know what tells me if something's funny? I mean, I think something's funny, but if I hear the noise of ha-ha, then I know it's funny.
Yeah.
So even if I have an idea, I got to get in front of people to do it. So I look for after a theater, if I'm not tired and there's a club around, I'll drop it in the
it's
club.
A different energy, right, in the comedy club versus...
I love it. Yeah. I love the intimacy of being right there and seeing somebody's face and just the immediacy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's great.
I mean, and just seeing the broad spectrum of your career, whether it be game show hosts, whether it be hidden camera stuff, whether it be children's television, whether it be stand-up, it's really cool to see how many things you've been involved in. And like we said before, how many fans... how that broad spectrum of fans that you have. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what Ghost Hunters does for you. I think it could really take you to that next level, and I'm really hopeful that that'll happen for you.
We didn't
you absolutely deserve it.
We didn't even get in, and maybe we can do this next time, but like the prank aspect of your life, and I know it's a big thing, but I want to maybe just ask this question. The clearly Oprah is a pal of yours.
No, that was me. See, that another highlight, that was me. She, when Deal or No Deal took off, she wanted to play it. So we went out to Chicago. We did it on her show, on the Oprah show. That's playing Deal or No Deal with Oprah.
Holy crap.
Yeah. That's how big it got.
It got huge.
How much money does Oprah have to win for her to get excited?
She was doing it for a charity.
Oh, okay.
Now, here's a question.
See, those are all the other things. There. I don't know if the next picture over is me. That's me in a line. I'm the second one with the shiny shirt. That's the 80s. I hosted Expo 86, the World Fair, on the same shelf as the Oprah picture. That's Charles and Di. I did a show with Charles and Di. For Charles and Di.
Wow.
How was that? Cool. Were you nervous?
Who's this idiot kid, you know, who really doesn't do much, you know?
Is that how you still think of it when you think of this stuff?
Yeah.
Like when you see his pictures?
My wife and I, every day, I never dreamed I'd live in California. I never dreamed I'd be in show business. From that amateur night at Yuck Yucks, there I am with Charles and Di. There I am with Oprah. There I am on the point of these pictures is that was the set of The Tonight Show. Johnny Carson was iconic in my house. You know, everybody watched The Tonight Show. That was the show. And that's, you know, I got his cards. You know, everything kind of, you know, Bobby's World right there. You see the Bobby's World thing?
Yeah.
That's the Happy Meal. We were the biggest seller.
Oh, that's right,
dude. I was a Bobby's World Happy Meal. In 1 week, they told me they gave out, we set a record, 40 million toys. So 40 million little, this thing where I sat in the room and I told you where the guy's going, I'm going,
here. This is what he sounds like.
And they're going, does he look like this? That was in every McDonald's. McDonald's was the biggest thing. That picture right behind you, that is Karen Van. I just looked at it. Yeah. That's the first episode, the first time I walked in stage, right here, the bottom one.
Yep.
And that's where I'm just staring into her eyes going, I got to throw out all my fucking jokes.
Now, not to knock you down a peg, but 40 million kids did buy those toys, but, you know, billions more didn't buy those toys, Howie. And that's
to me. Yeah. Welcome to me. I know that. That goes unsaid.
Yeah. Howie, thank you
so much. Yeah, this was so fun.
So that's the show. Thanks for tuning in. We had laughs and stories. Now go listen to more episodes on iTunes or your phone. Subscribe and tell your family and everyone you know. But what should I tell them? Well, you can just tell them that Brad Williams and Adam Ray can help you get through the fucking day. Just follow us on Twitter at Funny Brad, and I'm at Adam Ray Comedy. This has been the About Last Night podcast. We'll be right back. Hey, everybody, it's me, Tony Danza. Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast with Brad Williams and Adam Ray. Boy, they're a lot of fun, huh? Why don't you subscribe on iTunes to this fucking podcast? Give them a 5-star rating so this midget and this Jew can feel good about themselves for a couple minutes. Also, get on your iPhone or Android and get the podcast app. You can also listen to it on Stitcher or aboutlastnightpodcast.com, where you can hear past episodes with great guests like Lisa Kudrow, Paul Feig, Kevin Nealon, Bob Saget, Dion Cole, Chris D'Elia, Adam Devine, Michael McDonald, Jaleel White, Bud Friedman, Steve-O, Harlan Williams, Tom Arnold, Ron Funches, Rick Glassman, Blake Anderson, Anders Holm, Jessime Peluso, Joey McIntyre, and many, many more. I'm Tony Danza. Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast. Good night. That's it, right? You got it? Sweet. Boy, it smells good in that booth, by the way. What kind of candle is that? Hanukkah Willow? Nice.